short-term problem. Like, we keep on assuming that we're going to get back to normal at some point in the near future without actually doing the work to get to that point. Rapid tests are a clear example of this. Like, why do we not have them deployed on a mass scale? For Biden talks about deploying that number of tests out to people. It's roughly like 1.5 tests per person. And I also want to talk about the social measures that should have been put in place right from the start. Like, we know that a pandemic is a social problem. It's not just a biomedical one. Like, yes, vaccines and therapeutics and diagnostic tests are great, but we need things that actually allow people to protect their livelihoods and their lives at the same time. And paid sick leave is a great example of this. It seems like a really weird measure to be talking about in the context of a pandemic. But if you can't actually take the time off to isolate or to take care of yourself if you're exposed, if your workplace conditions don't allow you to do that, then how are you going to stop yourself from spreading this disease? Like, we know that these things actually matter and can have an immediate impact, but they don't seem to be part of the package of measures that we've been talking about. People sort of gravitate between just going on completely as normal or going to a strict lockdown. There are so many things in the middle. Like, we talked about masking, we talked about rapid tests, we talked about paid sick leave. Ventilation is important. Having places where people can isolate is important. These kind of measures are going on in parts of the country, but not everywhere. And there doesn't seem to be any sort of federal push to really make them everywhere, to pressure states into actually putting them into place. And that is part of the problem. That is why we're in this state where we're having these horrendous discussions about schools and where we're looking at a healthcare system that is collapsing under the sheer weight of infections.
Do you think this could lead to Medicare for all? I mean, it has exposed the fracture of the entire system, a system that was broken already in terms of who gets health care and who doesn't in this country. Now it's who dies and who doesn't.
Yeah. People who are unvaccinated are actually like the uninsured are make a disproportionate A lot of people who are unvaccinated are also uninsured, right? And that says something about the medical system in this country. Like, there's this sort of tendency to paint vaccinated people as all like antagonistic anti-vaxxers. And I think access is still actually a large problem that isn't really grappled with. I would hope that the lessons from these 2 years are that inequities harm us. You cannot fight a vaccine, cannot fight a pandemic properly in a grossly unequal society such as what we currently live in. But that doesn't seem to be the lesson that is being learned. Like, we've had lip service paid to the need to focus on inequities, but even from like leading public health voices, it seems to be a thing that is readily forgotten. And that is, you know, that is part of why we are where we are now. Unless we actually make efforts to protect the most vulnerable, to help people on low incomes, people from marginalized groups, disabled communities, unless we stop treating them like disposable commodities, we're going to end up back in this situation that we currently find ourselves in.
The Supreme Court hearing oral arguments around Biden's vaccine mandates. Your thoughts?
I worry that we are, instead of learning the lessons that you've just talked about, that would make us better prepared for the next one, that we are setting legal precedent in place that would actually make us more vulnerable next time round. And, you know, there are many different examples of this. State legislatures around the country have put in orders that make it more difficult for people to put in, say, mask mandates or quarantine orders. That contributes to how hard it is to fight something like Omicron. It is going to make it more difficult to deal with the next variants. It's going to make it more difficult to deal with the next pandemics, which I guarantee you we will face.
Well, Ed, we're going to have to go, but I wanted to wish you a happy 40th birthday. I know it was very difficult. You wrote a piece talking about canceling your 40th birthday because of Omicron. Thank you so much for being with us. Ed Yong, science writer at The Atlantic, won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the pandemic. We'll link to his pieces. That does it for our show. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
RCT in sound from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the influence of the U.S. military on both college campuses and in the pollution of our planet. We speak with Marcy Winograd about the military-industrial complex taking over our college campuses and universities.
We are speaking with Dr. Jim Rhine from Veterans for Peace Climate and Militarism National Project to learn what we can do to reverse the disastrous course we're on and reverse climate change.
The U.S. military is doing its best to wreck this planet. We've got to shrink the military. That's the bottom line.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
In 1961, President Eisenhower warned America on a nationally broadcast TV program of the, quote, unwarranted influence of the military-industrial complex. Later in the 1960s, the prestigious Senator J. William Fulbright spoke of what he named the, quote, military-industrial academic complex. And he was both prescient and wise to do so, for today's colleges and universities in America receive nearly $200 billion annually from the Department of Defense to do research and development for military means. And this money plays an oversized role in how our colleges and universities are funded today. Indeed, as you'll hear in a few moments from today's guest on this topic, the influence of this Department of Defense money on what is researched and taught at American colleges and universities is profound. And it contributes greatly to our pro-war politics while denying money and research for addressing problems like climate change, the curing of new diseases, finding new ways to fight poverty, or better educating our children. And with this year's Pentagon budget topping $768 billion, this should concern all who seek a more peaceful world, a world where economic and social justice prevails. Currently, 2,500 of the main institutions of higher learning in America receive this Department of Defense blood money for military-related research. And often, little is known by way of just what is being researched and developed for the military on our campuses, of knowing what new ways to kill people are on the drawing board. For example, my co-host Jim Lafferty, in preparing this show, found out that the University of Michigan, his undergraduate alma mater, ranks two or three among the American universities receiving money from the Department of Defense. Well, our guest today is an expert on the military-industrial academic complex, as well as a longtime activist for peace and social justice. She's Marcy Winograd. Ms. Winograd is the coordinator of Code Pink's Congress, co-chair of the Progressive Democrats of America's End Wars and Occupations team, and herself a former candidate for Congress. Marcy Winograd, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's my pleasure.
Marcy, you've had an interesting experience of late trying to discover how much and what kind of military research is being done at the University of California at Santa Barbara. When did you begin this investigation, and what hurdles have you encountered as you tried to learn what's what with regard to military-connected research contracts at UC Santa Barbara?
Well, Michael, you know, I've been involved in the anti-war movement for a long time, since the Vietnam War. And now I work with Code Pink. I host a show on Code Pink Congress with Medea Benjamin, the co-founder of Code Pink. And all of this led me to look at what was going on in Santa Barbara at my local university. I submitted a Public Records Act request back in April. I wanted to see all of the military contracts that had been signed, military-related contracts, from 2016 to the present. And well, 8 months later, I haven't received one contract, but I did receive an email from the campus council's office saying that they had signed 398 research contracts in that five-year period with both the Department of Defense and private military contractors. So I'm still waiting for the contracts, but I do understand that they have signed quite a few. In the interim, while I'm waiting for those contracts, I decided to launch a petition and circulate a petition, which urges the chancellor of the University of California at Santa Barbara, UCSB, Chancellor Yang, to not renew or pursue military-related contracts. So far, about 500 people have signed this petition in the area and in California. We'd certainly like to double that number, and if anyone's interested, they can go to codepink.org/UCSB to sign the petition.
You've learned that there are about 400 military contracts at UCSB. By and large, you've been stonewalled when it comes to learning who these contracts are with and what they entail. In one response to your request, you were informed that while there are, like I say, about 400 such contracts at UCSB, the university responded to your request by stating many, if not all, of these contracts have clauses that require a notification to the other parties that we have contracts with them. What's that all about? It sounds to me like an effort to hide what they're doing.
Well, it does sound like that. Certainly, there is no indication that this is classified material. Nowhere on the university's website does it say that they are involved in military-related research that is classified. And yet, I'm told, as you just mentioned, that the campus counsel's office has to check with the military contractors first. Now, they do contract with, we know they contract with Raytheon, which makes the laser-guided bombs for the Saudi-led assault on Yemen that has led to hundreds of thousands of deaths, 16 million facing starvation. They also contract with Northrop Grumman and with Lockheed Martin. These are the biggest military contractors or for-profit weapons contractors in the United States. It's really quite bewildering, however, if you were to go on to the University of California at Santa Barbara's website to learn more about this, because the projects, the military-related projects, are written in such jargon as to be almost unintelligible to anyone who doesn't have a PhD in some niche area of science. I want to read you just a couple of the titles. So when I started doing my research, I read about microbial systems, autonomous control of molecular transport, bipedal walking gates, or electronic, ionic, and mixed conduction in polymeric systems. Do you know what I'm talking about, Michael?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I don't think most people would have any idea what I'm talking about. So, but however, if you grab these descriptions and you put them in a search and you write military application, bam, you'll learn that, autonomous control of molecular transport is research on boosting soldiers' vision and hearing through chemical amplification. Bipedal walking gates are robotic soldiers. Mixed conduction in polymeric systems is about developing radar absorbent materials for fighter jets so they cannot be detected. So clearly, they're trying to downplay this research because it is written, the project descriptions are written in such a way that nobody would have any idea what they were talking about unless they had a PhD in some niche area, as I mentioned.
You've discovered that UCSB has a deal with Raytheon Vision Systems to develop microelectronics for mission and space surveillance systems. And according to Amnesty International, Raytheon supplies Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Republics with laser-guided bombs for a war on Yemen that's already killed over 230,000 people and left the country in ruins. Marcy, who gets to decide what sort of research a public university is allowed to do? Do the taxpayers decide that? Do you think a vote of a majority of the alumni from UCSB would approve of this stuff? What do people know, and what can they do to discover the university is trying to do research on new ways to kill innocent civilians in faraway places?
It really is quite disturbing when you think about it, Michael, that the taxpayers have no idea what's going on with these public-private partnerships. And at the end of the day, we have to point to the defunding of higher education as one of the reasons why this is able to happen in the first place. You know, the universities are scrambling for money. That's no excuse for pursuing military-related contracts. But it does explain, to some extent, why these chancellors and the administrators are able with such ease to pursue public-private partnerships that may be insidious. When I go on to the web and research the partnerships at the University of California at Santa Barbara, what comes up? Well, there's one that's called the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, that's DARPA. And DARPA, I think, funds quite a few projects at universities. This is to develop microelectronics for missiles. One of DARPA's goals, I'll say, is to incorporate, get this, artificial intelligence into air combat using autonomous fighter jets controlled by algorithms, not humans. Now, I couldn't find evidence that that is being researched at UCSB, but that's the ultimate goal of this agency that is partnering with UCSB. We mentioned Raytheon Vision Systems and its work on missiles and laser-guided bombs that are causing so much heartache in Yemen. The university, one of their institutes is the Institute for Collaborative Biotechnologies, the ICB. Back in 2008, about 300 students protested this, but since then it's been quiet while they continue to conduct research for future wars. They also partner with the Department of Defense's Bioindustrial Manufacturing and Design Ecosystem. It's called BioMADE, and what is BioMADE? The purpose or the mission, according to the Department of Defense, is to, quote, maintain military dominance. So I started drilling down on the BioMADE website, and it links to a project that ostensibly prepares us for future wars in which U.S. aircraft land in the middle of nowhere outside of one of the United States' 750-800 overseas bases on runways grown with a mixture of sand and bacteria. So BioMADE is about using synthetic biology for these pop-up bases.
You know, your petition calls for the severance of ties to the military-industrial complex, but what percentage of UCSB's operating budget comes from military research? And if UCSB were to do as you ask, would it not leave a rather large hole in its annual operating budget?
Michael, I have studied some of the budget documents online, not only for UCSB, but for the University of California and some of the other universities. And I have to say that it doesn't always align one budget with the next. So, for example, the budget at the University of California at Santa Barbara for research is $235 million. I don't see, however, that research budget is included in the operating budget, at least not to that extent. So without getting too far into the weeds, I'll just say, look, in looking at the research budget, $235 million for UCSB in 2019-2020, of that, about $40 million is provided by the Department of Defense. And in addition to that, you also have $20 million provided by industry. Well, which industry? It's not broken down, but as I said, we know, can easily search this online, that UCSB is partnering with Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Lockheed Martin. Some of them are located right here in Goleta. They call it the Infrared Valley. People think of Santa Barbara, think of Goleta, they think of the beach, they think of the beauty, and it is gorgeous. They might think of UCSB and the fact that UCSB has something like 68 Nobel laureates, a very respected institution, terrific departments in many respects, but not too many people understand that a lot of this research is on military-related industries. We know that, as I mentioned, they have these different partnerships. What would happen if they didn't have the money, if they didn't have the $40 million from the Department of Defense or the $20 million from industry? They get another $60.5 million from the National Science Foundation, which doesn't focus on military-related research, but it does fund some of it. What would they do? What would they do? Well, how about this, Michael? How about they don't research missiles? How about they don't research pop-up bases, overseas bases? What about this? What if they took the money away and they couldn't research the creation of super soldiers with chemical amplification to boost their vision and hearing? Would that be such a loss? I would argue no. There's no evidence that any of this research money is funneled into some of the other fantastic departments at the university. I don't think the creative writing program, which is outstanding at UCSB, is benefiting from the military research. So my response is just get rid of it. Don't take that money.
Well, if they get rid of it, where are they going to get the money to keep the campus going?
Well, as I said, there's no evidence that they need that money to keep the campus going. They can pursue money from other sources. Look, the state of California is only providing under 10% of the budget for the University of California system, which is really criminal when you think about it. However, I don't necessarily blame the legislators. I blame the fact that we passed Proposition 13 decades ago, and it's been very difficult for them to raise money to increase the per pupil spending at the University of California. But we have to look to the federal government, too, for more money. And there are other agencies and departments under the umbrella of the federal government that could be funding research. UCSB, like many of the universities, does receive money from the National Institute of Health, but they could get more money. They could get more money from the National Science Foundation, from the Environmental Protection Agency, from the Department of Agriculture and Commerce and so forth. There are lots of federal agencies. We don't have to look to the Department of Defense to hold up the sky.
I went to the University of Wisconsin, and I was shocked to learn that what I thought was a public university gets about 90% of its funds outside of the government. And I think that's probably true of all the major universities. They really are not public. They've been privatized. We've been speaking with Marcy Winograd from Code Pink, who's looking into the financing of universities, how much money comes from the Department of Defense to go into military research. Marcy, I suspect that many, if not most, Americans would be surprised to learn how much money and how much military-oriented research is being done at our colleges and universities. But should anyone be surprised? I mean, the annual military budget of the United States is greater than the military budgets of the next 11 highest nations combined. And in fact, is it not the case that in a capitalist country like ours, where profit is the bottom line, war and the makings of war would be big business and occupy such a large share of scientific research being done on our college campuses? In short, isn't this in large measure simply a byproduct of being a capitalist nation?
Michael, the short answer, yes. Yes. But the longer answer is that we can't wait for the empire, this capitalist empire, to retract before we redirect our resources from war and militarism to climate and sustainability. I mean, we're facing a climate crisis. So there should be all hands on deck for pursuing research that would benefit us, such as ecosystem restoration, forest regeneration, renewable energy infrastructure, sustainable cities, almost anything other than researching how to engineer radar-absorbent missiles and microelectronics for other aspects of the military would be preferable, because we know the Pentagon is the largest single institutional emitter in the world of greenhouse gases and consumer of oil. There are vast quantities of greenhouse gases that are released when you fly troops from one end of the world to the other, when you establish these bases, when you destroy infrastructure. There's a tremendous human toll. We know that. We saw that in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Vietnam. But there's also a climate toll. So it's imperative that we move away from university complicity in military research.
Well, let me ask you the big question, Marcy. What's it going to take to turn this situation around?
Michael, that is a big question. I wish I had an easy answer, but it's a lot of heavy lifting. Look, what happens because people, to a large extent, go along with the agenda, or they consent. They consent vocally or quietly, tacitly. And so if we really are serious about challenging the university's complicity in war and militarism, then we need to express our dissatisfaction, our objection. So what would this look like on a college campus? Well, you might have the student academic, the ASB, you might have the faculty academic senate passing resolutions calling for the severance of the university from the military industrial complex. You might have graduate students, many of whom are captured by this focus on militarism. They're recruited to work on these projects. They're teams of graduate students who work under these professors on these war-related projects. These graduate students are being exploited for their brain power. In fact, Raytheon even says on the University of California Santa Barbara's website, we develop technology at a fraction of the cost at UCSD. To me, that's a celebration of the labor exploitation that's underway here. So these graduate students, they could withhold their labor, even if it were just temporarily, to say, you know what, we don't want any part of this. We want other opportunities. It's going to take a lot of pressure. That's what we need. We need to organize, and we need to pressure, and we need to make our demands known.
Well, if people want to sign your petition, Marcy, where can they find it?
Yes. The petition is UCSD, Sever Ties with the War Machine. And that petition can be signed. I invite people to sign it at codepink.org/UCSB. codepink.org/UCSB. And if you forget all of that, you can just type into the Google search bar, Code Pink Petition UCSB, and it'll come up. This petition has been endorsed by a number of organizations besides Code Pink, among them UCSB's Environmental and Climate Justice Hub, the Truth and Recruitment Organization that's based in Santa Barbara, the Quakers in Santa Barbara, Democratic Socialists of America in Santa Barbara, Progressive Democrats of America, Committee Opposed to Militarism in the Draft, and on and on. So we have support, and now we're just trying to circulate the petition.
Well, it's really good work, and it's encouraging to hear what you're doing. Marcy, let's step back for a second and talk more broadly about Code Pink. Where did Code Pink come from? Why was it formed? What does it do? How can people get in touch with it?
Code Pink started around the invasion of Iraq 2003 to protest that invasion, the U.S. invasion, and then the subsequent occupation, and has continued to be a vibrant anti-war women's-led organization. We have a myriad of campaigns. For example, we have this campaign, UCSB Sever Ties with the War Machine. We have a campaign to lift the sanctions, normalize relations with Cuba. We have a campaign to stop the drone assassinations, to free Daniel Hale, who's sitting in prison for blowing the whistle on the civilians, the many civilians that were killed by U.S. drone strikes. We have a lot of projects and campaigns. I invite anyone who's listening to join us. You can join us at codepink.org, codepink.org.
We have run out of a lot of time, unfortunately. Do you have any final thoughts?
My final thought is that it doesn't necessarily take a lot of people to propel change, but it does take at least a few committed people. And so I would urge those of you who are listening who are disturbed by this increasing militarism, the agitation for war with Russia or China, the decision to build new nuclear warheads, which is what we're doing right now, to join with Code Pink or other anti-war organizations and speak up, speak out, organize. We need you.
Marcy Winograd, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Our hats off to you. Every success with your work, and a good new year to you. You take it easy.
Thank you, and you too, Michael. Happy New Year.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Although the U.S. military has called climate change an existential threat to national security, its actions belie its words. The U.S. military is the largest institutional source of greenhouse gases in the world. But due to a loophole in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement and the Kyoto Protocol, it is not required to disclose the extent of its pollution. Moreover, the 2021 military budget calls for the Pentagon to report on the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions for the past 10 years, but the Pentagon missed its July deadline. In 2020, the U.S. military emitted 51 million tons of carbon dioxide, primarily from fuel and the maintenance of over a half million buildings, according to the Cost of War Project at Brown University. Significantly, the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan emitted 1.2 billion tons of greenhouse gases between 2001 and 2017. Those wars cost U.S. taxpayers $8 trillion and killed 900,000 people. But the U.S. government's commitment to reduce emissions falls short of the goals of the Paris Agreement. The U.S. efforts were rated insufficient by the Climate Action Tracker. If other countries follow suit, the temperature would rise by 2 to 3 degrees Celsius, which would prove disastrous. In November, more than 100,000 people participated in demonstrations at the United Nations Climate Change Convention, the COP26, in Glasgow, Scotland. Upwards of 500 delegates to the convention had ties to the fossil fuel industry. The watered-down statement that came out of COP26 called for a phase-down of unabated coal power and inefficient fossil fuel subsidies rather than phase-out of fossil fuels. Dr. Jim Rhine is an adjunct professor of geology at Wayne State University, who for decades has published his research on marine geology, environmental geology, and the potential interactions of the U.S. petroleum industry to climate change. In 2019, he helped form the Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism National Project. The project helped draft H. Res. 767, which Representative Barbara Lee from California introduced in the House of Representatives in November. H. Res. 767, which now has 31 co-sponsors, calls on the Defense Department to report on its emissions, to set clear annual emissions reductions targets, and to pledge to conduct strict, transparent, and independently verified reporting on emissions. The resolution also incorporates the House version of the 2022 National Defense Authorization Act that says DOD should lower its emissions to prevent exceeding an increase in global temperature by 1.5 degrees Celsius. We are happy to have Jim Rhine with us today to explain the Veterans for Peace campaign and the House resolution. Jim Rhine, it's great to have you with us today. Welcome.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to represent the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project within Veterans for Peace. And Marjorie, I want to thank you personally for stepping up and being on the advisory board for Veterans for Peace.
Well, it's my pleasure. I think it's a very important organization, and I'm honored to be part of it. Jim Rhine, please explain what would happen if the temperature rises to 2 to 3 degrees Celsius.
Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, you know, I'm not a climate scientist, but I think it's obvious. You know, you look at what's happening now with all the catastrophes that are going on in the United States. I think in the last year, over $18 billion worth of damages weather-related. So you just extrapolate about 1.2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and you extrapolate that to 1.5 to 2 to 3 degrees. It's something that's very frightening. I would really like to discuss more, instead of, you know, listing all the bad things that would happen to the physical world, is point out the changes that'll happen to the dominant species, and the dominant species right now, You know, some people call this the Anthropocene. Are humans, you know, and how is this going to affect humans? And I want to drop back on my, you know, putting on my geology hat. You know, looking at literally miles of rocks over the decades that I've described geologic record, you know, usually the dominant species that's dominant before a major extinction like we're going through now in a climatic event is not the dominant species afterwards. So that said, you know, Marshall Burke from Stanford University has done some interesting studies looking at the economic impacts of rising temperature. And one of the things that I think pointed out in his studies is that, well, one, the economy will go down if we don't do anything about temperature rise. But the impacts are mostly associated or most impactful in the lower latitudes, closer to the equator, whereas the high latitude countries like Norway and Russia actually might see advantageous changes. So what's going to happen? All these folks in the lower latitudes, you know, not going to be able to feed their families. They're going to want to migrate north. You know, they estimate, you know, that the International Organization on Migration estimates that by 2050, there'll be as many as 200 million climate refugees, which is not a specific category, as you know, from the United Nations. Todd Miller, who's written a very frightening book, Storming the Walls, estimated that it could be as many as 1 billion people that will be migrating by 2050 if we don't do anything. And I think this threat, and it's already happening, you can see people are moving from the triangle in Central America, I think impacted, you know, the last election in that more people, 74 million people, voted for Donald Trump because they were afraid of this mass migration from the South. And in fact, you know, the United States spends vast amount of money on protecting its borders, a lot more than it spends on preventing climate change. Now, I will mention that I am worried as a geologist about at some point we might trigger a feedback loops, whereas, you know, like the methane's coming from the permafrost in, you know, the northern in Canada and Alaska, and also in Siberia, and also releasing the gas hydrates, if the oceanic gas hydrates, if those start emitting in large quantities, they'll actually get, there is more available methane and CO2 there than what we've historically emitted. And if we start doing that, then the human race is really in a bad situation.
So, Jim, tell us what steps are necessary to keep global temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial levels, which is necessary to avoid the most severe impacts of climate change.
Well, there are many things that can be done. I mean, there's very many avenues, which we don't seem to be doing hardly any of them. I really suggest that your listeners and yourselves, if you haven't already, go to an online program. It's called En-ROADS, a climate simulator. It's by Climate Interactive. And there's some videos that show you how to work. It's fairly simple to use. But you could plug in different scenarios like a carbon tax or promoting renewable energy, stopping deforestation, afforestation, which is planting new trees. And you can come up with your own to find out what is the most impactful on lowering future emissions by 2100. A spoiler alert, a trillion trees won't hack it. If you put in maximum afforestation a day, afforestation is planting new trees. Planting an area the size, twice the size of India, would only lower potential temperatures by 2100 by 0.1 degrees Celsius. I pointed that out in the talk I gave in Houston, and some folks were not very happy about it. If you recall, the Republicans have come up with a trillion tree plan, but like I said, it won't do very much. And let me also point out in the En-ROADS, you can go behind the cover, and there's a lot of references that they cite, and you can read, you know, what the science behind it. So instead of enlisting all these things that possibly could do, like a carbon tax, or a carbon fee, I was certainly for in the past, and I still am, but there seems to be no political will for it on either sides of the aisle. But again, I would encourage people to go and check out your own theories or the theories that are promoted by politicians to see if they would be if they're going to be effective or not.
How many metric tons of carbon dioxide did the Defense Department produce between 2010 and 2018? And what is the significance of this production?
You know, a lot of researchers like Nita Crawford from the Cost of War Project and the National Priority Project have come up with these numbers. You know, instead of saying these numbers or reading off the amounts, I want to point out that except for domestic facilities, military bases and support facilities in the United States, the Department of Defense does not have to report its emissions. So they only report, it's estimated about 33%. So the estimates that Dr. Crawford and the National Priorities Project have reported are based on estimates of fuel usage from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. All these reports can be accessed at Climate Crisis and Militarism Project website and our resource page. You can download these reports, look at them, and get those numbers there. I would say that just a number that's fairly handy is commonly used in these reports. In 2017, emissions were 59 million metric tons. This is, again, estimated for the Department of Defense, which equates to about the emissions of Portugal. But that doesn't count the emissions of the war manufacturers that support the military. Now, if you were to include them, you would probably double this. So instead of being equivalent to a country like Portugal, it would be more like a country like the Netherlands, which, as you probably know, is the home of the Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company. Now, the significance. Vice President Kamala Harris, in her address to the Naval Academy earlier this year, essentially said that one country's carbon emissions can threaten the sustainability of the whole Earth. So, if we can't afford to ignore the equivalents of Portugal or Netherlands, which would be DOD, then we're not going to be able to solve the problem of climate change.
I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Dr. Jim Rhine. He helped form the Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism National Project. Jim, in January of this year, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said that the Defense Department, quote, will immediately take appropriate policy actions to prioritize climate change considerations in our activities and risk assessments to mitigate this driver of insecurity. What are the prospects that the Defense Department will effectively make good on Austin's pledge?
My background is a research geologist, so I've been looking at rocks. I'm not a politician, but I will give my opinion. So he, like many others, civilian leadership in the Department of Defense, are part of a revolving door from the military, contractors, of which military contractors make up, or they consume half of the military spending that we have. So it's a big component. But it's a revolving door. And I think Forbes estimated that Austin made over $7 million being on various industry boards, military industry boards, since he retired. The question is, will he and other major civilian leaders in the Department of Defense think of the common good when they're making these decisions and pushing DOD to take action? Or are they going to be thinking about their own self-interest? So I really wouldn't want to venture a guess on how this is going to go down.
Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks declared in November that the White House has set a goal for the Defense Department to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. That's 2050. She said that the Pentagon is developing a sustainability plan that would reduce emissions and focus on developing a zero-emissions non-tactical vehicle fleet, adding, "We also know that we need to optimize energy use in our tactical vehicles." Jim, why is this insufficient?
Yes, why is this insufficient? I sat in on a webinar back in January before the inauguration, before Biden took over, and they were discussing about how it was a climate change and national security webinar sponsored by the Naval War College. And there was talk about, how the military was going to respond and to climate change. And one of the things that was brought up about budgets, and they thought that, well, the budget might remain stable, but probably military budget, but probably they're going to ask for more money to deal with climate change. Now, I'm not an engineer, but right now, bioaviation fuel, which is a major component of the emissions of, the Air Force, not biofuels, but fuel in general, is about twice as expensive as the fossil fuel equivalent, what we're using now. So, converting to biofuels, where are we going to get the money from? Now, Anatole Levin from the Quincy Institute published a very good opinion piece on the problem with, our military spending. And essentially, the title of it is Climate Change is Our Biggest National Security Threat. And essentially what he pointed out is if climate change is our major national security threat, why are we spending so much money on the military instead of spending it on climate change? So the push that the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project is trying to put out is that greening the military is not sufficient. What we have to do is we have to shrink the military. There's no way, that we can have such a large military and lower the emissions sufficiently to address climate change.
What does the 2021 National Defense Authorization Act require the Secretary of Defense to do in order to keep Congress apprised of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions? Has the Defense Secretary complied with this mandate?
As far as I know, they haven't. Now, I'm assuming when Representative Barbara Lee from California submitted her resolution that there was some inquiry as to whether, with their contacts with the other legislators who are on the Armed Services Committee, that there was no reporting. So it was only one section, about a paragraph, within a 1,000-page document, that specified that the Department of Defense had to report not only that fiscal year's, but 10 years back, and they had to do it within 180 days. As far as I know, that has not been reported. And I think, as far as I know, the vast number of Republicans that voted for the NDAA did not know that particular item was in the thing that they voted for, as probably many Democrats didn't know it either.
Jim, what are the most significant provisions of HRES 767, the House resolution that Barbara Lee introduced? Can you please explain that?
Well, first, for your listeners who might not know, it is a resolution, so it is a sense of Congress, kind of like the Green New Deal. So it is not a binding document like a law. But I think the major component is that the emissions of greenhouse gases, so the Department of Defense, they have to be monitored and reduced. What's quoted in the resolution is also in the House version of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2022. Now, I don't know if it's made it into the one that Biden signed just a few days ago, but according to that, it's in accordance with the science-based emission targets set out in the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2022, a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions consistent with preventing an increase in the global average temperature greater than or equal to 1.5 degrees. So it's saying that the Department of Defense has to come up with a plan to avoid at least their emissions, to avoid one exceeding 1.5 degrees. Now, again, I don't know if that is in there or not. Other parts of the resolution, there's a long, long laundry list, about 14 provisions beyond the one I just mentioned. But essentially, we modeled it after provisions and an initiative by the Conflict and Environmental Observatory Group in the UK. It goes under the acronym of CEOBS. And essentially, they had come up with the similar provisions, again, that we modeled our the resolution off of, to call for all the militaries within NATO to address military missions in the COP26. Now, let me also point out that in a NATO communique in June, they have stated that and all the allies, you know, the signers of NATO, which is including the United States, that they will develop a mapping methodology to help allies measure greenhouse gas emissions, and this will contribute to a plan to formulate voluntary goals to reduce such emissions. So NATO is already calling for this.
We're talking to Professor Jim Rhine, who helped form the Veterans for Peace Climate and Militarism National Project. Jim, what can folks who are listening to our show do to support the work of your project and to support the House Resolution H-767?
Okay, again, I just want to highlight that the main role of our group is to point out that the large military missions cannot be reduced sufficiently without shrinking the military. So what we're trying to do is point this out to other groups, environmental groups, climate activist groups, that they need to think about the military. So that's one of the things. So talk to the environmental organizations, climate groups that you belong to, and point out that they should consider military missions. Now, one way to learn about this is you can go to the veteransforpeace.org, and then you can find our web pages by looking at, there's categories, our work and the national projects, and that'll take you to our web page. Or you can just Google search on Veterans for Peace, Climate Crisis, and Militarism, and our website link will pull up. And once you get there, you can check out our resource page. I mentioned that before because there are many of the reports that I've talked about in this interview. But go to Support Congressional Resolution. They will ask you to fill out your location information to find out, you know, who your representative in Congress is. And there's already a template there, a letter that you can send requesting that your representative become a co-sponsor. Now, you could tweak. Let's say if your representative is Republican, you could go look up and see if they voted for the NDAA from fiscal year 2021 and point out to them that they've already voted for some of the major provisions that are in this resolution. So you can alter the letter. Or you can also, if you want more information about this, your organization, you can request a presentation and request a slideshow. That's one of the things that you can do at our website.
Jim, what kind of pressure was brought to bear and by whom at COP26 to focus on potential technological solutions and to exclude language calling for the phasing out of fossil fuels?
Well, again, I'm not a politician. I was not into the intricacies of COP26. I was too busy preparing or helping with a panel discussion we hosted on the COP26 coalition, which was outside the panel, which you can also access that panel discussion, which I highly encourage folks to do that at our website. But let me say that the Biden administration is pushing incentives versus carbon pricing or cap and trade. So I'm sure that the conversations that Kerry had and the other folks with the other delegates were probably pushing that. Now, I do know, as probably many of your listeners know, that the U.S., along with China and India and Australia, did not support the phase-out verbiage that, you know, had a phase-out of coal in the final document that came out from COP26. But let me add just some other statement here, and I'm not really answering your specific question, but I'll just sort of summarize the Veterans for Peace statement on the COP26 and why we feel the U.S. was a very contributing factor to the what we considered a failure at COP26. And essentially what we feel is that, you know, why should other nations support both United States friends and foe prioritize action on climate when the USA spends more in 1 year on so-called defense than the total 10-year funding for climate action that was proposed in Biden's Build Back Better plan? So, you know, in this recent Pentagon budget, it was, you know, almost $780 billion for 1 year, whereas Biden's Build Back Better plan envisioned $555 billion over 10 years, and that hasn't even passed. And finally, you know, the Biden's promise to double the funds for the Green Fund, you know, by 2024 to $11 billion per year, that's less than what was added to the budget over and beyond Biden's defense budget by Congress. So it was an already bloated budget, and Congress added about $20 billion to the defense budget, which again is more than what Biden's calling for in addition to the Green Fund. So we really don't have any credibility there. Why should other countries put themselves out when we're spending more on defense, far more than we are putting out for climate change?
Jim Ryan, thank you so much for appearing on Law and Disorder and explaining to our listeners how important it is that we take concrete steps, effective steps, to reduce and reverse climate change before it's too late.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jim Ryan, keep up the good work. We totally support you, and we hope that you and your colleagues have a good new year. Take it easy.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you too.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Reversing our declining birth rate does serve an economic goal. An ever-expanding workforce raised with a minimum of public spending and a maximum of women's unpaid work. Why would employers pay for parental leave if they can get away with not providing it? And why would corporations pay taxes for a national child care system if families can be induced to take that burden upon themselves? But women and all parents are refusing, as our lowest ever birth rate demonstrates, and that gives us some leverage. As the birth rate goes down, the value of our unpaid labor raising successive generations can be seen more clearly by everyone. So we think it's time to bring the battle out into the open and raise some demands. What's a strike without demands, after all?
That's Jenny Brown, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jenny Brown on women, labor pains. Reproductive rights and abortion are under sustained political attack. Texas, Mississippi, and other states have passed highly restrictive laws limiting and in some cases eliminating access to abortion. In all, nearly 600 anti-abortion laws have been introduced. The Supreme Court, with its three Trump-appointed justices, seems poised to decimate, if not overturn, the court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion. In 2018, even before the pandemic, the birth rate in the United States reached its lowest level in decades. The pandemic has further reduced childbirths. Feminist activists assert that declining birth rates represent a work slowdown or strike in the face of the poor conditions for those who do the work of bearing and raising children. For millions of overworked and exhausted women, the financial burden is significant. They must be compensated. Our guest today is Jenny Brown. She's a national women's liberation organizer and former editor of Labor Notes. She was a leader in the grassroots campaign to make morning-after pill contraception available over-the-counter, and she was a plaintiff in the winning lawsuit. Her articles appear in Jacobin, Alternate, and other publications. She's the author of Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now, and Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work. She spoke at UC Berkeley in December 2019. Her comments remain relevant given the current threat to Roe v. Wade. And now, Jenny Brown.
I was part of a group of women who worked from 2003 to 2013 campaigning to make the morning after pill, basically after sex contraception, available without prescription in the United States. So dozens of other countries had this when we started. It's also known as emergency contraception, and the pill is a higher dose of the hormones found in oral contraceptives, and it works by delaying ovulation. It's effective up to 120 hours after sex, but it's most effective the sooner you take it. So the prescription requirement meant that if you needed it, say, starting on a Friday,